My name is Chuck. I'm a real grateful recovering alcoholic. First thing I need to tell you is when I woke up this morning, I rolled out of bed and hit my knees and thanked God for another day of sobriety. I asked him to give me strength to do his will, not mine, and I asked him to allow me to be a vessel to come in here this afternoon and carry the message and not the mess. I read page 86 through 8 out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It starts off on awakening. Let us think about the 24 hours ahead. I read the meditation for the day out of the Daily Reflections and a couple other non-AA approved literature books. At 7:30 this morning, I called my sponsor. I've been calling my sponsor every morning for the last 18 and a half years. I work with several alcoholics, and I'm in this meeting, and that's five things they told me down in Houston, Texas. If I practice on a daily basis, chances are I wouldn't drink any alcohol or smoke any crack cocaine. I'm also a rock star, so if you ladies would like to talk to me after the meeting, I'd be glad to give you my...
They say get close to the mic.
Okay, how's this? Can you hear me? Anyway, I like to have fun. You know, they told me if I wasn't having fun in this program, I need to go out and do some more research. So I know this is the International Convention of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'll keep my sharing to alcoholism. I don't want to offend anybody. So I told you my sobriety means more to me than anything in the world. I need to tell you my sobriety doesn't revolve around my life. My life revolves around my sobriety. Without my sobriety, I wouldn't have a beautiful wife. I wouldn't have a host of friends. I wouldn't have anything. I'd either wind up locked up or covered up. So anyway, I hope you can get something out of this message today. I hail from Houston, Texas. My home group is the Heights group. It's probably the best home group in the United States. I know it is in Texas. And I got a host of friends out here from Heights. We drove up here 2 days ago in two vans. And you spend about 13 or 14 hours with a van full of people, you really practice some love and tolerance of others. That's for sure. But anyway, we're here to talk about corrections. I sobered up March 3rd of 1997, and my sponsor, I'm also an ex-convict. My first TDC number is 216638, and my second TDC number is 2335 18. My sponsor is an ex-convict. My grand sponsor is an ex-convict. I have a lineage of guys that are ex-convicts. And I sponsor guys that are ex-convicts, you know. And they told me when I got out, don't hang around with them guys. But, you know, I'm either going to hang around with guys in prison or I'm going to hang around with guys staying out of prison, some of y'all. I want to tell y'all that if you're not involved in correctional work, I really suggest that you get involved. That blue can over there, it's a can we pass around in all our meetings. We have a blue can or a white can. Texas is divided into four sections, northeast, northwest, southeast, and southwest. In southeast Texas, we have two entities, intergroup, which is a white can, and then CETA, which is the blue can. And we put one in either basket at a group. We don't put them both in. And the money in the blue can goes for prisons, in county jails, prisons, and hospitals and institutions. The white can with intergroup just goes for Texas prisons, and that's what I'm involved in, Texas prisons. I'm trying to give you all as much information as possible. One of the requirements for doing this kind of work is not that you've done time. So if you're out there and you've never done time and you're not involved in corrections, don't think that you don't have something to offer, because trust me, these people know how to go to prison and do time. What they don't know how to do is to get out of prison and stay out of prison and become productive members of society. So I really suggest that get with one of us if you're in the Texas area. If you're not, get with one of these volunteers that are... I met some people from all over the United States that are doing this kind of work. If you come to Texas, give me a call. We have a special volunteer program. One of the requirements to be an approved volunteer in Texas in the prison state prison system, you have to have a year of sobriety, and you can't be on paper. Being on paper means that you are not on parole for 18 months. Okay, after you've done that 18 months, you check with your parole officer. If they're okay with it, come on and join us. We have a special volunteer program where you can go in four times as a special volunteer. We bring them in with 30 days, you know. just to let them, you know, this work isn't for everybody. I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that all y'all need to be doing this, because some of y'all probably feel uncomfortable doing this. Rightly so. I feel uncomfortable picking up cigarette butts. I don't smoke cigarettes. I don't make coffee very well. You know, there's some things that we just don't feel comfortable doing. So, I'm not going to get on your case if you don't want to go into corrections. But I do have your badge number, and I know where you live. But anyway, I'm from Houston, Texas. I was born and raised there. When I came from a normal family, watching Leave It to Beaver, I'm a product of the 60s. Ward came home and kissed June. June kissed Wally, and Wally slapped around the beeve. And if you've never seen Leave It to Beaver, it's on Turner Network. So check it out. But anyway, my father died when I was 15 years old. He overdosed on sleeping pills. I remember my mother telling me, "Chucky, you need to take care of the family because you're the oldest." And what I heard my mother say was, "Chucky, I want you to go out and do what you damn well please." So that's what I did. You know, when I started lying, cheating, and stealing before I picked up my first drink, I turned 17, I became an adult, or at least through the eyes of the state of Texas. And before I turned 18, I got my first TDC number. If any of y'all are from Houston and you lived in Houston in the late 60s, I was a very big car thief. I made all the newspapers. We had 3 papers in, the Press, the Post, the Chronicle. I was stealing these Corvettes and Ferraris. That guy needs some water? I was stealing Corvettes and Ferraris and, you know, I tell you what, you get up here on a podium, man, you start lying, and in a minute, I'll start believing my own lies, you know? I stole Volkswagens. Remember I told you? Remember I told you I was a product of the 60s? That was the vehicle of choice for the wild and crazy bunch, you know? And I got 3 years in prison for stealing a Volkswagen. And dang, y'all laugh the same way they do back home. How much time do I have? 12 minutes, okay. I got out of prison. My mother was the only one that came to see me when I was in prison. I asked her where my friends were. She said, "Chucky, they're not your friends. If they were your friends, they would write you. They would come by the house and ask for you." I didn't want to hear that. When I got out, my friends were right there for me. They were my friends, you know. I went back home to my mother's. I picked up right where I left off. I had no kind of skills at all. My dad died when I was 15. I started stealing. That's all I know how to do. You know, you can't fault a man that all he knows how to do is cook soup. You ask him to cook a steak, he's probably not going to do a very good job, but if you ask him to cook some soup, he's going to probably make a good pot of soup. And the only skills I had was stealing cars, so I took to stealing Corvettes and Lamborghinis. Damn, that guy needs some water or something. I stole another Volkswagen, okay? I hadn't heard about insanity, doing the same thing over and over, expecting different results, and I stole another Volkswagen, and I went back to prison for 4 years. One day I looked in the little 6x9 stainless steel piece they had on the wall for a mirror, and I said, "Chuck, if you keep this up, you're going to become an old fart in TDC." And I made a promise to myself, I'm never going to steal another car, and I didn't. And when I got out, I got married, because that's what my problem is. I need a woman in my life, you know? Right? Right? Yeah. I got married and the drugs came into the picture and 6 months later my wife threw me out and I went back to my mom's house. And then in 78 I did a geographical move. I moved from Houston to Pasadena and met another girl. All these women I had marriages with they were living in their parents' houses, you know, and I thought, well, shoot, they've got kids and they can't even own their own home. That's what my problem is. So I bought me my own house and you know, it just craziness. You know, I didn't think I had a problem. I knew I had a cocaine problem, but I could drink and I could smoke pot and all that other stuff, but I just couldn't smoke cocaine. And when my life kind of got unmanageable, I'd sit way in the back of the room And when they'd ask me to share, I'd say, man, I'm just passing through, you know, and I thought that I was better than all y'all. See, I hadn't lived under a bridge yet. I hadn't eaten out of a dumpster yet. I hadn't had those yets. YET, you're eligible too. And, finally, what my bottom was that I wound up stealing money from my mom to support my drug habit. Every time I drank, I didn't go to jail, but every time I went to jail, I was drinking and drugging. You know, and I couldn't put all this together. You know, I had a resentment towards my dad because he had committed suicide. I couldn't even see that my brother went without a father too. You know, or my mother went without a spouse. My mother and father never told me they loved me, and I had real deep-seated resentments towards that. And when I did my fist it with my grand sponsor, he asked me if I ever had to go to bed hungry, and I said, no, sir. And he said, did you ever have to go to school with dirty clothes? And I said, oh, no. My mom was a stay-at-home mom. And he said, well, maybe your mom and dad was showing you the love that was shown to them. And see, I'd never heard that before. And things started making sense to me then. I grew up in a halfway house. My life was unmanageable. I checked in there March 3rd of 1997. I stayed there 9 months. It was a 90-day program. Some are sicker than others. At 3 months sobriety, my sponsor and my grand sponsor, we have a unit called the Darrington Unit in Houston. It's down off the old 288. And I knew they were involved in corrections, and I wanted to do something. I never thought that I would be able to go in the front door and out the same day. And we're going down 288, and they're in the front seat, and they're talking. And Rudy said to Rito, hey, we got a good speaker today. And I said, yeah, who is it? And they turned around and looked at me and said, you. And that's kind of, you know. But what I've learned, I don't do my sponsees that way. You know, I give them a little, you know, hey, we're going to go to the prison. If you wouldn't mind speaking, we'd like you to speak, you know. Just because my sponsor shits on me doesn't mean I have to shit on the guy. You know, I'm just, that's figure of speech, nothing personal. Nothing personal, Rito, wherever you are. You know, I got involved in correctional work, and I haven't looked back. I go to 7 prisons a month. I tried to go into the county jails. They wouldn't take me. Maybe it was because of my criminal background. I don't know. I signed up for the federal corrections, and they wouldn't take me. But there's over 100 state prisons in the state of Texas. We're celebrating the Walls Unit, where my friend Kent and his sponsor Tom I went and spoke a few years ago. We're celebrating 69 years of continuous AA meetings behind the walls. They claim it's a second. They claim it's the second oldest prison behind San Quentin that's had continuous meetings. You know, I heard it's third, fourth, fifth. It doesn't. We just say it's a second one, and I'm real grateful to be a part of that. You know, I'm very involved in my service work. You know, I pray in the morning and I read the material and I call my sponsor and I go to a meeting and I still feel squirrely. I go work with one of y'all, man. And it pulls me out of my stuff every time. I live with alcoholics. You know, I have a beautiful wife and a little dog over there, Jackson. This is his first anniversary, international. Hopefully he'll go to plenty more. But, you know, I have a host of friends. You know, I can't say enough about this kind of work. If you're interested in this thing, you know, you just think about this. You go into a gated community. Okay? Don't you hate when guys and gals are walking out and smoking and they're going up and getting coffee and this or that? There's none of that in the prisons. You know, it's a very structured, you know, very structured. In fact, it's so structured, they've got guards in the towers with guns to keep people from coming in and burglarizing your meeting. You know, man, it's good to hear y'all laugh, you know. I'm real glad to be here today. I don't know how much time I got, and I could probably talk for the rest of the day, you know, but I'm having a real good time out here. This is my fourth international, and I brought my sponsee, Paul. It's his first. We got a couple other people, Lillian, Marie, I think, Gary. We've got some volunteers out here that are active, man. It's like doing a good shot, you know. Once you do it, man, it's like I got to have more, and there's just not enough hours in the day to do this kind of work. We carry the message. We don't carry the convict. It's about being a good example, not a good bad example. We have in Huntsville, that's the hub of the volunteer services. We have a good support group up there of people in the professional side that's willing to work with us. They're very helpful. Just great. Am I almost out of time? Oh, I got 5 minutes. Well, that's pretty good. Sir?
Keep it rolling.
Keep it rolling. Okay. At our high school, we say, keep it coming back, you know? But anyway, you know, when I got here, y'all told me to hang with the winners. Y'all told me a winner never quits and a quitter never wins. So what I've learned to do is don't quit. That's right. Surrender, man. That's right. But, you know, I haven't met these other two speakers yet. You know, I haven't met a lot of y'all. We're just friends. We just God hadn't put in our paths yet. And, so I'm, you know, I want to hog all the hour but I've learned to be of service. And, you know, I came here, I was a selfish SOB. And today I'm a selfless. I'm still sometimes an SOB. But, I'm here to serve. So I want to thank y'all for my sobriety. And if anybody hadn't told you they love you today, well, guess what? I love you.
Thank you, Chuck. I just wanted to tell you a little bit about why they sent me an email asking me to do this. And do I have any friends from North Carolina here? All right. I got sober in North Carolina Department of Corrections. 1992, I went through the DART program. He talked about his gentleman sponsor, Tom I, instituted that program in North Carolina Department of Corrections in 1988. And I went through it in 1992. They told us while we were there, I was there with 128 other convicts, and they told us two of us would be sober in a year. And I looked around and wondered who the other one was going to be. I hadn't worked the steps very well yet. But I love corrections. I've been involved in corrections since I got sober. My home group, I went in there arrogantly at 6 months sober, went to a business meeting, and they had been telling me to read this service manual, and I saw all the positions in there. I wanted one with a title. And because I said, I've been making this coffee and greeting people for 6 months now, and I have potential. And what they did is they very gently chided me and told me, one of the old timers stood up and told me, well, Phil, you are absolutely right. They said, we have the perfect job for you. He said, we would like you to be the correctional facilities representative of our home group because nobody in this home group has been to prison more times than you have. I did three stretches in North Carolina Department of Corrections, and my friend here, I had to tell him when we met, I says, I've spent many stretches in the Harris County Jail in Houston, Texas. And 30 days one time just for assaulting a police officer. They don't take kindly to that. And so my heart is in corrections. I'm involved in West Virginia in District 1. I'm the correctional facilities chair. I have been the past area chair for the correctional facilities. And we just meet a lot of challenges going into correctional facilities, but the thing is to just stay focused and keep beating down the doors, and eventually, you know, things will move if you find the right person to talk to. So, I'm going to introduce our next speaker, and she's from the other Virginia, but I would like to introduce you to Christy E. Thank you.
Wow. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Christy Ellis. I am psyched because there's so many people in here that want to talk about corrections. This is amazing. Woo-hoo! That's what it's all about. Thank you for sharing, Chuck. And I look forward to hearing John. I got to know John. We were doing the Carry the Message Pavilion, which is really awesome. If you haven't been there, I'm sure you have, but if you haven't, check it out. And we worked a booth. And well, you had already worked it, but you hung out with us, and it was a bunch of us just sharing stories. And, man, it's just powerful stuff. I do have a sobriety date. It's April 12th, 1988. I have a sponsor. I call him a tour guide. I've always had a sponsor. And I sponsor other women, grateful. Some of them are here. It's really great. We just walk shoulder to shoulder doing this deal. And I've got a home group called the Awakenings Group. We meet on Sunday mornings at 9:30. It's an open speaker meeting. Woo! And we have babysitting, which is neat because they didn't have babysitting when I got sober and had three small children. I was a single mom, and I carried my kids to meetings with me, and they sat in the corner and colored because I did whatever I had to do to stay sober. I was dying. And you showed me a way out, and I grabbed your hand, and you showed me the way, and I'm here today. I'm amazed that I am, and I'm just so grateful to God, who is my higher power, and these beautiful friends, all these Richmond folks are here. Yay! And just other friends that I've met. And to me, this is about bringing hope behind the walls. And that's what I'd like to talk about, hope. Because that's what happened for me when I got here. I was very broken. I was dying of alcoholism. I was 30 years old. I'm 58 years old, I'm happy to say. I've got six kids and three grandkids. Well, four grandkids. My son just got remarried and has I have a new grandson because she had a son. And life is good. I got three dogs. I'm a quantity girl. I love a lot of anything. And anybody that knows me knows that. But anyway, point being that life is full and it's good. And I know why I got this life. It's because I was broken and I was desperate and I fell into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I heard people describing how I was feeling inside and I didn't even know their names. And it got my attention because I didn't know that other people thought, drank, and felt like me. I didn't know that. And it was music to my ears. And then I left that meeting and my alcoholism started running its mouth saying, oh, that was just over there. So I went to another one and I heard it again. And it's the hope. And I just feel like that's what we do. We carry the hope. And I got sober a few weeks later. It was a whole lot of stuff. And I believe in the identification. You need to know that I thought, drank, and felt like you, or you're not going to care about what I got to say. You know, because we connect. The drunk in me sees the drunk in you. You know, and I am you and you are me kind of stuff. And so I did. And I was broken and I was dying. And I had three small children. I was living with my parents for the umpteenth time. God bless those people. And I was 30 years old and I thought my life was over because I didn't even want to drink anymore and I couldn't stop. And I had called a treatment center because some people had told me about their folks in their lives getting sober. And of course, you know, I still had that little bit of me going, I wonder why they're telling me that. But, you know, anyway, they were carrying the message to me. And I went to those meetings and I had gotten in trouble about 6 months prior for some stuff the DEA doesn't look kindly on. And so I had a whole lot of stuff going on. And it was just my surrender. I was brought to my knees through a lot of events. And I woke up April 11th, 1988. And there was something different. And in Language of the Heart, Bill Wilson talks about the greatest gift we get when we get here is the spiritual awakening. We must awake or we die is what it says. And it goes on to say, if you don't put legs on your prayers, basically, then you're going to drink again. And I awoke that morning. It was an awakening for me. I knew something was different. I went into my job. I said, I'm dying. I need to take a leave of absence. I don't care if I lose my job. I called that treatment center and I went out there for 28 days and I physically got sober because I was 100 pounds and I didn't even know how to eat. For God's sake, I was smoking cigarettes and drinking all the time and eat a piece of cheese every now and then to make myself feel like I was getting some nutrition, you know, but that kind of thing, you know, but it was basically, and I was, you know, had these three beautiful children, 8, 7, and 5, and I just wanted to be a good mom. And I'm watching people driving to work, wondering what that feels like. I'd give you $1 million just to be one of those people. And it just seemed so out of reach. But that day I woke up, it was an awakening, and I went into treatment, and I just was begging God to remove the obsession to drink, and I woke up April 12th, 1988, and I haven't had a drink since. And I had a similar experience. You talk about the two people in treatment, they said 1 out of 10 of y'all are going to make it, and I'm like, well, I know I'm making it. I don't know about all y'all, because there's a way out here, you know, and I didn't even know till that time that there was a way out. You know, I thought that was going to be my life or I was going to die. And so I said, I want to feel like you. Look, what do I got to do? And they said, get a sponsor. So I did. Get a home group. So I did. Get a job in that home group. So I did. And I was a greeter in the coffee maker the first year. And I think they're the best jobs in AA, personally. They are. They're amazing. You got to make yourself a part of the we. And that's how you do that. How do I make myself a part of the we? I walk around and introduce myself at meetings. I stand at the door. I try to remember your names. I do anything I can to make yourself a part of the we. And because it was a busy home group, one of my friends in the home group at 9 months sober said, hey, Christy, you want to go out to this prison with me? I was like, sure. Because I learned that okay was the most spiritual word I could say, and it was, and it still is, really. And I haven't stopped saying it, and I fell in love with corrections. Now, before I got sober, I said I got in trouble for that stuff the DEA doesn't look kindly on. And so they had put that aside, and when I went to court at a year sober, they didn't even recognize me. The transformation had been so powerful that they didn't even recognize me when I came. And the prosecutor was asking the judge not to give me any time. What is that about? I mean, that's crazy. And so all I did was show up and do what we do here and kind of put that to the side, because that's certainly not why I got sober. And I got sober because it was my time to get sober. And I went to that meeting in that prison and fell in love with corrections. Fell in love with corrections. 3 weeks later, that girl stopped going. That happens sometimes. Y'all know that. I'm sure you've had that experience. People say, come on, and then they disappear. But that's okay. I figure she was just the link in the chain. That's all I'm supposed to be, too, is just a link in the chain. That's it. She was my link in the chain to hook me into that. And I started going out there, and it was really different back there. I was 9 months sober, and they basically just said, let me see your ID, and you can come on in. You know, about 3 or 4 years later, they decided that maybe they might want to check security and see if you had anything in your past. And but, you know, that time sitting there in that courtroom, and my lawyer saying, tell the judge what you've been doing, and that, you know, the prosecutor saying all that, I was thinking about that actually earlier, because I woke up this morning already doing my talk to y'all. I was. Oh, and I didn't tell y'all, happy, happy Saturday, and happy 4th of July. And and I can't think of anywhere I'd rather be than with you beautiful, fine people that are my people. God bless you. I love you. And so that moment, it hit, you know, earlier when I woke up and was already talking, I had this thing, you know, God, he put some that stuff in there. He intervened. And he made, and I had a moment of clarity and realized that was a very pivotal moment in my life, because little did I know that he had a whole bunch of stuff he wanted me to do carrying message behind the walls. Now, I didn't know that then. I just know that I was dying and I was willing to do whatever it took to stay sober. And I did, and I have been continually since then. Why wouldn't I? For God's sake, I got an amazing life. Why would I stop doing what's giving me the gift? You know? And so I started going in there, and I really, you know, and it was just a bunch of women trying to stay sober. And that's what I told them. Anytime, you know, that was my first experience with just a bunch of women trying to stay sober. Behind the walls, no less. But eventually they were going to get out. So let's make the best of it while you're here. And I saw me in every one of them. You know, because it's a level playing field, you know, I'm you and you are me kind of stuff. And I told them that, you know, and I would share my early recovery stories, you know, and so I did that prison for a while, and I'd carry the hope to them that they could have it too. And a lot of them are moms, you know, and I'd let them know how you can rebuild having kids. We recreate our lives. We don't have to do it alone. That's the good news. And there's plenty of others that can walk with you and show you what they did. Because that's what we do. And I would take speakers in, because speakers are great because of the identification. But the main thing I did was I'd get that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous out. Because a lot of times I've found that folks don't really understand alcoholism. I mean, when I got here, it all sounded like Greek to me, you know? So I get a sponsor, and the steps make sense because my sponsor's walking me through the steps. I get involved in service, and the traditions and the concepts, they start making sense. I see them in action. I start realizing I can use them in my own life. I got 36 principles I can use. Beautiful. But I didn't know that stuff. It all sounded like Greek to me until I got involved. And so I feel like that's my responsibility when I go in there. Let me share the program of Alcoholics Anonymous with these ladies so that when they leave, and I've had the experience of seeing them when they leave and be a part of their lives and why they rebuild their life. In that first prison, I did that for a couple of years, and then my job changed because I'm rebuilding my life meanwhile with my children. I had gotten rid of everything, including you men who I thought was a part of the solution for God, some reason. And I was just me and the kids, you know, rebuilding my life. And my mama would come over once a week. And we say mama in Virginia, okay? And Anyway, my mama would come over. My parents were so grateful to see their daughter alive and to see, you know, and see the lifeline that you were. I mean, she would come over once a week so I could go out to that prison and carry that meeting. So there wouldn't be dark nights. And if you're already involved in corrections, you know we don't want any dark nights. And sometimes they only have one meeting a week. And a dark night's when somebody's supposed to be there and they don't come. And that's just, you know, you got some folks in there that are hanging on. They're hanging on. They might have the grapevine. They might have softback books to read. But there's something about us coming in and sharing the message with them. And my mom would come over once a week. And they were just so grateful and just such beautiful people that I'll be forever grateful that they, you know, helped me. And my kids saw me change and everybody saw, I saw me change. And I was like, wow. And I could share that with these ladies. And so, you know, as if we suit up and show up here, our life changes and it moves forward. And it's like one thing prepares us for the next thing, prepares us for the next thing. And if I look back, I can see that God's got it all lined up. I just don't need to get caught up in wondering what it is because I'm really good at that. You know, it's like, God, I want your will, but tell me what it is so I can start planning, kind of that thing, you know. And so I had to get out of that stuff and just kind of like, you know, one day at a time, let me do the deal here. And I'm a big believer in living in the middle of the circle and triangle, you know, and it's a safe place. Never seen anybody relapse. It's done that, to tell you the truth. And so I switched jobs and then God just calls you. I mean, he just does. He's called me everywhere I've been with corrections. He's called me and let me know there's an opportunity for me to serve. And so someone told me about an opportunity at a jail, but you could only go at 3 o'clock on Wednesday afternoons. And I had a job where the guy knew I was in, his father was in recovery and he knew I was. And I just asked him about it and he said, sure. And he let me off every Wednesday afternoon to carry that meeting into those ladies. And it was so special, you know, to have that kind of support. And he knew about it because of his father. It's just that long arm of AA stuff, you know, and just that ripple effect how we have. And we know if we're really active that folks around us know about it. And so, and then I got some other ladies involved and it was really great. And they got to know me there. And that's the thing about when we do that, something I've learned is showing the folks that work there our consistency, that we are going to show up. The folks behind the walls, and they're expecting us not to show up because people haven't shown up for them a lot of times. People will say, yeah, I'll do it. Yeah, I'll do it. And they learn that we do what we say we're going to do. And I'm a big believer, if you're not going to do it, don't do it. Don't say you're going to do it. Because somebody's life is on the line here. This thing's about life or death. And if you've got somebody sitting behind the walls and wants to know about a spiritual solution, that's big. To me, that's really big. And so I take it really seriously. And so I went in that jail for quite a few years. And I was the corrections chair at Intergroup. And our district didn't have committee chairs back then. And so there were a lot of facilities. So I got to know a lot of people. And I'm a busy girl anyway. I've always been attracted to the busy people. I love the busy people. And so, you know, you get to know. And that's one of the benefits of doing service. You just meet so many people, you know. And it's just amazing. And so I went into that facility for a while and got some ladies involved. And I remember one Christmas, they made me a Christmas card out of a folder. They were so proud of that little folder. Now, we know the value of that. I still have it. You know, I still have it. I mean, it's like I want to frame it and hang it up. You know, it's like for them to take the time to make that, to think enough of me. And it's not me. They're thinking enough of us. Because I'm clear with them, this ain't Christy. This is the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm just the link in the chain here. I'm just the messenger. I'm just letting you know there's a way out. And in that jail, I had a girl ask me when she's getting ready to be released if I'd be her sponsor. And I just was like, yeah, here. I mean, no, yeah, she did. She said, will you be my sponsor? Can I have your phone number? And I said, yeah. And I watched her rebuild her life for 5 years. I watched that girl take this program and put it in her life. And I got a front row seat and I got to be right there. And I would have missed that. That's so priceless. And that's just one of hundreds of stories. You know, I want to share about each facility I've been in and let you know just little. I don't have that 5 minute thing yet, do I? Okay. Okay. My husband says you get an hour and a half talk and 45 minutes with me. So you're good. I got 7 minutes. That means you will get 30. So, my math's a little off. But anyway, I get excited. I'm sure that's not hard to tell. But it's the passion. It's the passion. It is the passion for sure. And I watched that girl rebuild her life. And what a great thing to watch her literally rebuild her life. And and then I started going in another jail. And I went there, and a friend of mine, Deb, where are you, Deb? Raise your hand. She's in here, and she, yeah, Deb. We did that together, and it was so great. And something that's so special to me is about the early sobriety stories, because if I say I've been sober 27 years, that looks like unattainable. Oh, my God. You know, it's like I remember seeing people with 30 days when I just got sober, and I was like, daggone, 30 days without a drink. Oh, my God. You know, and now one day at a time, you know, we get that. The weeks turn into months, into years, you know, and but you just can't get caught up in that. But when they're sitting in there and they're looking at you, it's like they're expecting you to rise up, and, you know, it's like, whoa, no. Let me tell you some stories about me to make sure you know that I got my feet planted here. And I did some stuff. I'm not in AA just because I want to be. I mean, I need, this is my lifeline here. I mean, I do want to be. Don't get me wrong. But I want to live. I want to live. And so this girl. And so I would tell them the stories about my first apartment. And it was really important and very special. My three small children, a girl and two boys. And I got my first job. And my apartment, I used to run around over-explaining why people needed to rent to me. And, of course, they wouldn't get a rent based on all the crime. I was telling them because I was reporting in to my sponsor instead of calling her first. And so I called her. Nobody's going to rent to me. And she said, just say, keep it really simple and ask people. Tell them you're trying to restart your life and rebuild. And will they give you a chance? So I did. And they gave me a chance. And I can remember walking through that place. And my kids are asleep. And I wanted to do it on my own because my parents could have done it for me. But I really needed to do it. I needed to be self-supporting. And I was just pinching myself. I was going like, wow, this is my place, man. And I would share that story with the ladies. And when Dennis and I, my husband, that I did meet the guy I was supposed to be with, because I got a bad picker, I'm going to tell you. And married him in 2001. He's my buddy. And we were moving to Carolina for 2 years. And the girls told me when I went to tell them goodbye, they were like, Christy, just wanted to let you know, so-and-so wrote us a letter and said she got her own place. That's the hope. That's what we do. We let them know. You can have it, too. I tell them. I don't have anything you can't have. Highest you get here, sober. Gotcha. 5 minutes. And I left there, and we went to Carolina, and then we moved back in 2005. And the prisons where we were living, they were really far away, and I did hook in with the community there. We've got a bunch of friends in Carolina that are involved in corrections. So we would go to things here and there, but it wasn't anything consistent. I missed it. It's like shot in the arm, what you're talking about. It's huge for me. And got back, and there's God for you again. He's calling me to another facility that needs help. And so I started going in there again. And then this last facility, they stopped the meetings at that where I was going. And I was like, golly day. And I just had to have faith, which I do. I have reliance and trust that he's going to plant me where he needs me most. And a friend came to my home group one morning. And he said, Christy, there's nobody taking meetings out where my daughter is. It's called Henrico East, and it's a regional jail, and they have a TC unit. It's a program they started in their therapeutic community within the jail. And he said, my daughter, there's nobody coming out there on Tuesday nights. And I was like, okay, God, thank you. I mean, he's letting me know. Come on. So I got my clearance and started going out there and went out there every week for a year. And what was powerful, actually, for a year and a half, I mean, I'm still going. And it was a year ago. We started last January. What we did was, you know, the lady, we're talking about the steps and we're sharing about our lives. And I'm a big believer in sharing the book with them. And one of the girls goes, you know, I just hear people talk about steps all the time, but I need somebody to really sit down and show us. I was like, okay. So our intergroup donated almost 50 books. And I did a book study with them every Tuesday night. And I said, put your name in the front, put a circle in the triangle. And, their lives changed, and some of them have gotten out, and I see them at meetings. And I had a girl the other day, I saw her at my home group. She came and she said, hey, you remember me? I still got that book, and it's got all that writing in it and all those notes and all the stuff you told me about. I was like, man, I'm getting chills thinking about it. And so the deal is, all it is going, I mean, it might not be for everybody. But the thing is, it's a place to go to share hope behind the walls and to let them know that they can have it too, because we are a lifeline. We're each other's lifeline, all that we do. And I'm going to close with a quick story. I hope I have time. Okay. And there was a girl named Kelly, and she I met her in this program, and she was a girl that sadly woke up one morning on Christmas morning and had killed two. Her two best friends were dead in the car, and she'd been the driver. And that's a lot. She was 21 when it happened. That was 10 years ago. And she never drank again, but she was trying to escape through a whole lot of other things and kept going back to jail, back to jail, back to jail, because she couldn't deal with it. And we know that there are folks in our fellowship that have had that experience, that are living very good, successful lives. And I have people in my life that have had that experience. And so I had them come in and share, because she'd be adamant, I don't believe in God. I don't do this. I'm not doing that. I don't care what y'all say. Y'all may not like it, but I just don't believe in God. And we hear that from people out here. And so I said, that's okay. So this is about attraction, and this is about sharing our experience, strength, and hope. So I took a friend, and y'all know one of our friends named Jeremy. I took him in, and he had a similar experience, and he shared his experience, and he was 14 years sober, and he'd been in and out for years, and he had a similar thing happen. And he shared his story with her, and she started crying, and it broke through, and she was ready to try this deal, and she did. And she was ready. She said, Christy, will you sponsor me? I said, yeah. And she'd call me, and we started working the steps, and she got moved to another facility, and they had no meetings there. And she would call me every day, and we worked the steps on the telephone. Now, tell me that ain't something. And I'll hang up the phone every time from talking to her, and I'd go, man, I would have missed this. I would have missed this. And so my point being is that I'm just a link in the chain. I'm just willing to do God's work and help God's kids. He shows me where he needs me the most. But there are folks that are incarcerated that want to live lives. Court Corrections Correspondence Program is huge. We are a lifeline. I feel like it's my responsibility to do that. Today was just my turn to tell my story. That's it. It was just my turn, just like it was their turn. That's all it is. We all have a story to tell, and that's how we help each other through our stories. I have an amazing life through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have beautiful children, other children, a beautiful husband, dogs, grandkids. Most of all, I have my life, and I like me, and I have people like the folks I meet behind the walls and people like you that I can rally with and celebrate sobriety with, and that we're alive, you know, and I do have something to give, and I can be I'm just one of God's kids trying to help God's kids. And the last thing I'll say is, I don't think my words will ever, 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 ever tell you or show how grateful I am, but I can only pray that my actions do. Thank you.
Thank you, Christy. At this point, I would like to just take a minute to ask if I have any volunteers from the Walton Correctional Facility in Florida. There is a young lady who is in the audience who would love to meet you up here after the meeting. You are carrying the message to her father, and she'd like to thank you. I wanted to thank Christy again, and in Virginia they call them Mama, and in West Virginia we call them Mountain Mama, right? All right. And I wanted to share with you that earlier, when my home group elected me as the Correctional Facilities Representative, I got to go into the same facility where on Christmas Eve, my first 9 months sober, on Christmas Eve, I got to carry a message of hope to the inmates that I did time with. And there's no way today that you could get into the same facility where you were housed. But we had an old timer named Harold who had been going in there for 18 years. And the warden said, if you're okay with Harold, you're okay with me. And so I got to go in and do that. And you just can't imagine how it feels to go back into a facility where you were housed and carry a message of hope that you people gave to me. And I want to thank you for that. And then I also wanted to let you know that I told you I did 3 stretches in prison and in North Carolina. And I just retired recently from one of the largest banks in the country where I was a vice president And I was in charge of $110 million worth of your people's money. And they gave me the key to the front door. But that's what can happen, you know, when you stay sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I know that Tom, I had that same very similar, killed two people in a blackout, and he became a warden. So, I mean, how do you explain that other than God's grace? That's what I've been given, is God's grace to have a life beyond my wildest expectations. At this point, I'm going to introduce our final speaker, and it's Don Kay from Ontario?
Close enough.
Close enough.
I just flashed this mental image that Phil's the warden, and he's going, "It's time, John." I'm an alcoholic and a member of the Heritage Valley Group in Carleton Place, Ontario. We meet Mondays and Thursdays. We're about an hour south of Ottawa, and if you're ever in the area, we'd love to see you. My name is John. I was taught to introduce myself in that order because those are the order of the three most important things. First, that I am an alcoholic. I know what my problem is. Second, that I am part of a body of people who are engaged in a spiritual program of recovery. And the last and least important thing is my name, who I am. And I'm going to tell you, I run into burning buildings for a living, and I am scared to death right now. I also got to warn you, I come from a long line of Methodist preachers, and it's dangerous to get me up behind anything that looks like a pulpit. I don't know what the heck I am doing up here with you folks. I mean, I feel like a buck private that is lost in officer country, because I've never been a corrections chair or anything like that. I mean, I'm good at following orders. I'm good at giving orders, but I am not very well suited to working in committees unless I have a taser or a cattle prod. I'm going to tell you a little bit about my experience in corrections. My sobriety date, by the way, is February 27th, 1993, for which I am eternally grateful. My first AA meeting, however, was just after Christmas in 1974. I have an older sister who just celebrated 40 years in this program, and she 12-stepped me when she was 6 months sober, because even at the age of 18, she knew I needed this program. I spent another 18 years out there running my life through the meat grinder. Can you all hear me? Am I close enough? I've never had a problem being heard before. Okay. Yeah. Ask the guys in my station. You know what? But the thing was, the seed was planted. So don't ever feel like you are too new in the program to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because she was, as I say, 6 weeks sober at that time, and she planted the seed. And when I was ready to wave that white flag, I knew where to come. My first sponsor and my grand sponsor were both active in corrections. They've both gone on to the happy hunting ground. They wanted to get me, as soon as I had that year in, they wanted to get me active in corrections as well. I was scared. You know, I had all these rationalizations about why that wasn't a good fit for me, but basically it came down to I was scared. One of the things was, you see, I never even did an overnighter. I'm one of those guys that somehow tiptoed through the minefield and through a combination of dumb luck and low cunning and the fact that I carry a badge for a living. As I say, I never did an overnighter. Used to be back in the 80s, I think it's changed now, but back then, at least where I come from, if you were a firefighter, the cops and the firefighters had certain, you know, exchanges of professional courtesy. And one of the things was, unless you actually killed someone or something like that, the cops, and they thought they were doing you a favor and saving the taxpayers, you know, all the time and money for a trial. And so they'd just be judge, jury, and executioner, take you in the back alley and just beat the snot out of you. And they honestly thought they were doing me a favor, keeping my record clean, keeping my license for me, and they thought that they were teaching me a lesson. What they didn't understand was that I wasn't drinking because I wanted to. I was drinking because I had to. I had no choice. I needed to quiet that noise inside my head. Like I said, I'm scared to death. Oh, man. And you know what? I drank for so many years so I wouldn't have to feel anything. Because in the fire department, I deal with death, destruction, and mayhem on a daily basis. I can't tell you how many dead people I've seen. I mean, I see more in a day than hopefully most of you will see in your lifetime. And the very first day that I reported to the fire station, the senior man in my truck died. And we went back to the captain's office, and there wasn't a lot of drinking on the job. I'm not trying to say that, but what happened was a bottle of whiskey appeared, and we drank that away, you see, and we didn't talk about how we felt. So, and since I got sober, I haven't been able to stop, you know, crying and stuff. So, anyway, let me tell you about corrections. So, 3 years after I got sober, I was selected. I was the first firefighter from the city of Toronto to be selected for the International Firefighter Exchange Program. And I got sent over to Australia for a year. And that was an incredible experience. And I got over there and, you know, I had 3 years sober by that time. I had this program by the Short and Curlies, you know. I mean, I was ready to rewrite the big book, bring it up to date, you know, make it a little more relevant. And some funny thing happened. A couple of things happened. I got over there in Australia, and one thing, this little voice in the back of my head started up, and it said, you know, if you had a drink over here, John, nobody would know. And I started getting restless, irritable, and discontent, so I called up my sponsor, Tim, and I said, you know, I'm just not feeling right. I'm, you know, kind of got that itchy feeling all over. And he said, well, you need to get involved in service, you know, like I've been trying to get you involved in the correction stuff. And I went, yeah, whatever. Okay. Thanks. Nice talking to you. And I had got a temporary sponsor in Australia, Arthur, and I called up Arthur and I told him the same thing. I said, you know what? I mean, I'm loving the meetings here. I'm loving the fellowship and all that stuff, but there's something just isn't sitting right with me. And he quoted that passage out of the big book. There is nothing that will guarantee recovery so much as working intensively with another alcoholic. And guess what? We need a lot of help with our prison program over here. And I thought, you son of a bitch, you've been talking to Tim, haven't you? And being the kind of, I don't know about you folk, but, you know, when it says defiance is one of our defining characteristics. So I thought, okay, I'll show you this won't work. So I signed up for the corrections program in Canberra, Australia. Got my clearance and I went in. And over there they do it one-on-one. And so I get into this little room and there's a guy sitting across the table from me, an Aboriginal fellow. And I had no, what am I going to say to this guy? We come from two completely opposite backgrounds. I mean, how could we be more different if we tried? This guy had grown up in an Aboriginal community in the center of Australia in horrible poverty, racism that you could not believe, basically cultural genocide for the last 200 years. I had grown up in an upper middle class family in a nice neighborhood in Toronto, all the advantages you could possibly imagine, good education, all that. We couldn't possibly be more different. What am I going to say to this guy for damn? And we sat there in absolute silence for what seemed like an eternity. It was probably maybe 30 seconds or so. And by the way, in Aboriginal culture, silence is not uncomfortable. It is taken as a sign of wisdom. That's something I could learn. But anyway, and this fellow's name was Joseph. I looked at Joseph and I just had no idea what I was going to say to this guy. And I just finally blurted out. I said, you know how when you wake up in the morning and you're so sick and you're so full of shame and guilt and remorse that the only thing you can possibly do is dive right into that bottle, get as drunk as possible, as fast as possible, so you don't have to think about that crap anymore. And he said, yeah, mate. I know exactly what you're talking about there. And you see, all that stuff that I had built up in my imagination, all those illusions, which was the, you know, there's the poster child for alcoholism, illusion, you know, what is it, fear, false events appearing real, yeah.
And you know, it just all melted away. And the rest of the hour, I don't know where it went, you know. And Joseph and I just talked back and forth. And I said, it doesn't have to be like that anymore, you know. There is an answer. And I don't know what happened to Joseph. I never saw that man again. And I don't know if he stayed sober. But boy, did that ever make a powerful impact on me. I want to tell you about another man I met. I did not meet this man inside the corrections. His name is George. And he's a member of the Anishinaabe First Nation in Canada. And I met him on a motorcycle trip. And we met at a meeting in Wawa. We were both happened to be passing through at the same time. And George had done his time. He had killed his best friend in a blackout, in a bar fight, over a woman that he can't even remember her name or what she looks like. And he did 20 years for that. And he got sober inside, got his 10-year medallion inside. And when he got out, we talked to the meeting, and then I just had to hear more, and we talked after the meeting as well. And he told me about how he returned to his native community in the far northern reaches of Ontario, and how he is now a respected elder in his community, and how he is trying to be a role model and a mentor for young people in his community. And there is so much need for that in the native community in Canada, and I'm sure in the United States as well. You know, those people have suffered so much culturally, economically, and everything else. And alcohol, unfortunately, is the last refuge for so many of them. But George is up there doing work with young people, trying to keep them from going down the same path that that he went down. How are we doing? 10 minutes. 10 minutes. Oh, boy. Get ready for the sermon. I fell in love, like the other speakers. I fell in love with corrections, even though I have never done a stitch of time. Like I said, not even an overnighter. So if there's anyone out there that is interested in correction, but you're feeling that, I'm not sure, you know, it doesn't matter. It's one alcoholic talking to another, sharing a spiritual solution to our malady. And I'm probably not going to take up the rest of the 10 minutes. I've worked in a variety of, or I've taken the message into a variety of institutions in Ontario. I feel like the newcomer. I need that half full cup of coffee again. Oh, man. I want to tell you about a guy, and I might get choked up about this. Like I say, I drank away my emotions for a lot of years, and for the last 22 years, they're just right there at the surface. I want to tell you about a guy I met in the Ottawa Carlton Detention Facility, which is where I take the message in now. And his name is Marcel. I met him just over a year ago, only met him once. And the way the system's set up in Canada, if you are... there are two levels. There's federal prisons, and then there are provincial jails or correctional facilities, as they call them. And if you're in a correctional facility, it's for one of two reasons. Either you're doing anything less than 2 years, you're doing provincial time, or you're doing dead time awaiting trial or waiting to be sentenced. And Marcel had just been sentenced. He had just pleaded guilty, confessed to doing a terrible thing. We don't ask what they're in there for, but he chose to speak about this to me. And I'm not going to share that exactly what that was. You don't need to know. That's not important. But he could confess to doing a terrible thing. And he was going to Millhaven Penitentiary, which those of you... Where are my Canucks in the crowd? All right. Yeah, those of you that know about Millhaven, it's one of the darkest holes in the Canadian penal system. And... He had been doing some you know, some time waiting for his trial and everything. Anyway, long story short, he was just celebrating 6 months of being clean and sober for the first time in his life that he could remember since he was able to walk, basically. And he said, even though I'm going away for a long time, and he said, for the first time in my life, I feel free. Because I'm clean and sober, and because people have brought the message of Alcoholics Anonymous into this facility and allowed me to finally feel like a human being. And
And he asked me, he said, would you pick up a six-month chip for me? Because we can't take anything like that inside. We can't even, where I go, you can't even take in a big book. We're allowed to take in the grapevine now because it no longer has staples in it. But, you know, we can't take in a chip. So, that's Marcel's six-month chip. I went back to my home group the next Monday night, and I picked it up for him, and I'm keeping it. And I'm hoping one day God puts Marcel back in my path again so I can give it to him. Okay, I can pull it together. I want to tell you, you know, you can tell I feel strongly about this. Corrections has done so much. I don't know how much good I have done to anyone in the facilities themselves, but I'll tell you, it has added a dimension beyond belief to my own recovery and sobriety. Those three guys, Joseph, George, and Marcel, are only the tip of the iceberg. It's good for me because, you know what, and there's a lot of guys that come into meetings and facilities that are just there for the coffee and the cookies, and that's fine. You know what, I went to AA for a lot of years without any real desire to stop drinking, but the seed got planted, and when I was ready, I knew where to go. Hopefully that happens too. Some guys are just there to get off the range for a while because, you know, like combat, you know, jail is pretty much, you know, 90% boredom and 10% sheer terror. And if guys just want to, you know, come into a meeting and kill some time, that's, you know, that's fine with me if they're not disruptive. I'll tell you the other thing, and perhaps one of the most useful things for me, especially in the facility where I'm at, because we get guys cycling through, like I said, they're there doing dead time, and then they're off to another facility or whatever. And we have four different institutions within the one. We have minimum, medium, and max, and women's. And all of us cycle through all four of those on a regular basis. So I don't get to see the same people on a repeated basis. Usually at most I'll see someone two or three times at most. And then, you know, it's there. And I got to leave it in God's hands. You know, I'm the kind of boy that needs to turn to the last page to see how the story ends, you know. I like to, you know, it's that controlling nature in me. But I can't do that here. I just have to go in, share my experience, strength, and hope. Share the, you know, and that's it, the hope. The hope, because there isn't a lot of hope in jail. But when you can tell people honestly from the heart, and when we look at each other in the eyes of the window to the soul, those guys know when you're bullshitting them, you know. And when you can honestly say that I know how you feel. I know what it's like to think that the barrel of a 12-gauge in your mouth is the only way out of this. I know what that feels like to wake up sick and desperate in the morning. And they look you in the eye and they know that you're telling the truth. And you can tell them honestly, it doesn't have to be like that anymore. You can get out of this place. You can be like George. You can rebuild your life. You can become a respected member of society. You can join the fellowship of the Spirit, and I hope I meet you as we trudge the road of happy destiny. Thank you.
Thank you, John. It's been a really, really, really good time to share about working in correctional facilities. And I want to, if you would, please help me thank the speakers again.